submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock with Albernaz against the United States. Ms. Meisner, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the question of whether consecutive sentences can be imposed for separately charged violations of two conspiracy provisions of the 1970 Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act, where those two provisions were violated by what the Court below found as a matter of fact to be a single conspiracy with dual objectives. The facts are briefly that following the seizure of a large quantity of marijuana from a freighter on the high seas, petitioners Albernaz and Rodriguez and 16 others were charged in a two-count indictment. Count 1 charged a conspiracy to import marijuana in violation of 21 U.S.C. Section 963. Count 2 charged a conspiracy to distribute marijuana in violation of Section 846. Now, the two counts were absolutely identical as to the alleged conspirators, the alleged time and locus of the conspiracy, and the overt acts set forth in furtherance in each count. They differed only in the object of the conspiracy alleged and in the statutory provision that was allegedly violated. From the outset, the prosecution treated the two statutory violations as a single conspiracy, stating in his opening that the conspiracy charged in two counts is actually a single conspiracy, that at all times the planning was the same, to go find someone with a boat, with reliable people, to go out to sea and meet the freighter. And the government's evidence focused on the petitioner's involvement in arranging to bring the marijuana from this freighter offshore to the United States. However, since petitioners had enlisted the aid of Drug Enforcement Administration agents to provide the boat to transport the marijuana, the plan never came to fruition. After some of the cargo was transferred, the Coast Guard moved in and seized the freighter, and the petitioners and two others were arrested in Florida later that day.
The conspiracies here were conspiracy to import and conspiracy to distribute.
Yes.
Nothing about simple possession.
No, they were charged as simply a conspiracy to import and a separate count of conspiracy to distribute.
Right.
But in fact, they were based on the same facts,
right,
and the Court below found
that
a single conspiracy. And indeed, the evidence that the Court used to permit the finding of a plan to distribute was evidence that was also relevant to the plan to import, and which was evidence that the Court found could be inferred a plan to distribute, but not a separate, independent, distinct conspiracy to distribute. Now, on bank, the Fifth Circuit reaffirmed this finding of a single conspiracy, but affirmed the imposition of the consecutive sentences on a finding of congressional intent to authorize, and a finding that there was no double jeopardy involved here. Now, in a number of recent opinions, this Court has stated that in determining whether multiple punishment for separate statutory violations that arise out of the same transaction are permissible, the first and primary question is whether Congress intended to authorize such punishment. If Congress didn't intend to authorize multiple punishment, that's the end of the inquiry. Now, the congressional intent must be clear and unambiguous, because criminal statutes must be strictly construed, and the rule of lenity requires that ambiguity be resolved in favor of the defendant.
What do you have going for you here besides the rule of lenity?
The legislative history provides an affirmative explanation for the existence of the two separate conspiracy provisions that has nothing to do with any intent to impose multiple punishment for a single conspiracy that has two objectives that happen to fall on each side of the subchapter line, an artificially divided subchapter line.
And but that would not be an argument that relies on the Braverman case.
No, this is a question of congressional intent, of using the legislative history to support to show that there is no affirmative congressional intent to impose multiple punishment, or that at best it is so ambiguous that the rule of lenity must be applied to.
Is the inquiry pretty much the same as in Simpson and Busick?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the rule of lenity a discretionary concept, or how would you describe it?
Well, I suggest that it has constitutional overtones in terms of being based on a desire not to impose punishment, additional punishment, unless Congress has spoken clearly and unambiguously, unless Congress has provided fair and clear adequate warning, which an adequate warning and clarity is an integral part of due process of law.
But, of course, you don't impose punishment initially. You don't impose punishment initially unless Congress has spoken clearly and ambiguously. So there's nothing different in the second sentence from the first sentence in that sense. If Congress has laid down the standard like in Lanzetta, where it's difficult to figure out what it means, you apply the rule of lenity and say, we just don't know what it means, and therefore we won't convict.
But this goes beyond that, to go beyond a situation where a statute is facially void for vagueness, to a situation where it's the application of two statutes to a particular factual situation.
Ms. Meisner, the hypothesis for the application of the rule of lenity has to be that it's ambiguous whether a course of conduct constitutes one offense or two. There has to be uncertainty about that particular problem, doesn't there?
Well,
and if there is uncertainty, then the rule of lenity requires that a court find that the intent was to impose only one punishment. Isn't that it?
Well, it goes beyond that, because Congress may well have not intended to impose multiple punishment where two statutes that under a strict application may not be technically the same offense, when those two offenses occur in the same criminal episode or same criminal transaction, Congress might not have intended multiple punishment.
Well, exactly. And the rule of lenity has nothing to do with double jeopardy, which is an absolute prohibition. But the rule of lenity simply says that when it's not clear that two offenses were intended, then it shall be presumed that there's only one. Isn't that it?
Well, I think it's more than that, than a strict application of two offenses are one offense. It depends how you're defining that equation. The government has argued that these are not the same offense under the Blockberger test.
Well, maybe they're not. But nonetheless, Congress, if it's not clear that Congress intended that two separate punishments be imposed, then regardless of any Blockberger test, then the rule of lenity says only one should be imposed.
That's,
isn't that correct?
That is our position, yes.
Well, that is the rule of lenity, isn't it?
Yes.
And its hypothesis is that there be an ambiguity as to whether one or two punishments are to be imposed.
Yes.
And you say there's an obvious ambiguity here because the courts that have construed it have come out in different ways.
That's one indicia of ambiguity.
And that's one clear indicium of ambiguity.
And another indicium is the way that the government has treated prosecutions that involve this type of conspiracy, charging them both in one count and in two counts.
Right.
Would you say that we begin to think about, turn our minds to the rule of lenity in about the same situation that we turn to the legislative history if we find ambiguity in a statute, but not otherwise?
Well, I believe that you can look at the legislative history even if the language is clear on its face, but I believe that
here... Well, we can, but do we? Is there a rule that we look to the
it's a discretionary.
The statute is clear. Isn't there the plain meaning rule?
Well, but this is the kind of case where you're talking about the facial clarity of the words themselves, but their joint and simultaneous application to a particular fact context.
Well, if the language of the statute, to go back to Justice Stewart's discussion with you, if the plain meaning of the statute is apparent, do we look either to the legislative history or give any thought about the rule of lenity?
We don't have that situation here because the...
Well, I didn't ask you whether we had it. I said if it's plain, because it might be plain to some and not be plain to others.
Well, in that case, I suggest that if it's plain to some and not to others, then there's an ambiguity that must be resolved by looking at the legislative history.
The people who think it's plain are not likely to agree there's an ambiguity.
Are you contending, then, that out of the 93 judicial districts in the United States, if you can find one district judge to say that it's ambiguous, the rule of lenity applies because we have one judge saying it's ambiguous, even though 92 others say it's not ambiguous?
I'm saying that might be one indicia of ambiguity, but here we have more than that. We have statutes that on their face say nothing about how they are to be applied in the context of a single conspiracy that's charged as violating both provisions. It's like the situation in Whalen and Busick and Simpson and Jeffers, where there are two separate statutes that are not void for vagueness, but in terms of how they are to be applied in a particular factual context where there's a single criminal episode, then there is some ambiguity that must be resolved by looking at legislative intent and other tools.
When you say that, you say there's a single criminal episode, a person may be convicted for a conspiracy without more. Is that not so?
That's true.
And then if the conspiracy is executed, that's a separate crime, isn't it?
Yes. This court has, over the past years, the conspiracy is a somewhat unique area, and this court and other courts have drawn lines and have said that as a matter of history, tradition, and because you have different, you're penalizing different objectives, you can punish the conspiracy and the substantive offense because the purpose of the conspiracy is to punish the agreement, which is the evil, rather than the objective which forms the substantive offense. Looking at the legislative history in this case, the government has conceded that it's silent on the question of multiple punishments. I suggest it goes beyond silence and provides an affirmative explanation for the existence of the two provisions. It has nothing to do with intent to impose multiple punishment for a single conspiracy. As proposed to the Congress by the administration, the legislation that turned out to be the 1970 Drug Act had one conspiracy provision that penalized all offenses, and that's the way it went through the Senate, as one conspiracy provision. In the House, because of the intricacies of committee jurisdiction and House Ways and Means' desire to retain control over import-export provisions, the legislation was divided between that committee and the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee.
And doesn't that in itself suggest that the House perceived that importation and distribution pose distinct social evils?
No, I think that what it suggests is a division according to whether these were domestic offenses or whether they were internal, external offenses. In some way to further congressional committee jurisdiction. If you look at Section 801 of the Act, which sets out the congressional findings as to what are the social dangers, you find that they list importation, manufacture, distribution, possession, all equally. There's no indication that importation is any more heinous than any of the others. Yet a conspiracy to manufacture and distribute and is punishable under one conspiracy provision, 846. suggests that manufacture is the functional equivalent of importation. It puts
Explain it away then purely on the committee structure of the House of Representatives.
I would suggest that that is an affirmative explanation as to why there are two separate provisions as opposed to the one that was proposed by the administration and that went through the Senate. And in addition, Senator Dodd said that he perceived no major difference between the House and the Senate legislation. And certainly if you're talking about the accumulation.
Could I interrupt you at that point? Do you have a copy of your brief in front of you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you turn to page 19?
Right. I noticed the citation is missing.
And indeed it is, and I'd like you to give it to me.
It is the October 6, 1970 congressional record.
You can do it afterward, okay. But I'd like you, if you would, by letter to the clerk, to give us that specific citation.
I shall.
I'll confess I tried to find it in a cursory examination, and I would like it.
I will provide that tomorrow. Looking at the statutory structure as well as the legislative history also supports a conclusion that Congress didn't really intend to impose multiple punishment for a single conspiracy because of the possibility that a conspiracy with two objectives that fall in one subchapter are penalized only under one statute. For example, the manufacture distribution, which is analogous to the importation distribution. And there's no rational basis for assuming that Congress would intend to punish those two types of conspiracies differently. And the government has conceded in its brief.
Let me pose a hypothetical. Suppose there were a statute that a conspiracy to import and distribute shall be punished twice as severely as a conspiracy to do either one alone. Would that, in your estimation, be violative of the Double Jeopardy Clause?
Well, I suggest that because of the interplay of two factors, one of which is the somewhat unique aspect of conspiracy law, and the other is the fact that importation and distribution are basically two integrally related and almost inseparable offenses in most circumstances.
Well, what if a person was importing for his own use?
I suggest that that's a very rare circumstance.
What difference does it make whether it's rare or common? Is it a crime to import for your own use?
Yes, it is a crime to import for your own use.
And then if you sell some to some other people, that's a crime, isn't it?
Yes, but we're talking about conspiracy, which is simply the agreement.
Well, I was addressing myself to your thought that there is no difference between importing for your own personal use and importing for distribution to other
people. Not suggesting that there's no difference. I'm suggesting that they are kind of, in most contexts, very interrelated. And
well, of course they're related. You don't, if you're going to distribute it, you've got to import it in some way.
Well,
you're not suggesting they can't be made two separate crimes.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that the substantive offenses cannot be made separate, and I'm not suggesting that if you have two different agreements to do each of those objectives, you couldn't be punished separately. I'm saying that where you have one agreement that involves both of those objectives, then it raises questions as to whether this is the place where the court should draw lines, as it has done in other areas of conspiracy law, and say that you cannot, that to subdivide a single agreement with two very closely related objectives, simply in some fundamental sense, does constitute multiple punishment for the same offense and cannot be imposed consonant with the protections of the Double Jeopardy Clause.
Well, then you would really require a metaphysical approach to the thing, that there's only a certain atom, or that you can't split atoms of crime, something to that effect.
Well, I'm saying that conspiracy is kind of a different animal, particularly this kind of conspiracy where you don't need, under the drug statute, you don't even need an overt act. It's simply a crime of agreement. If you sit in a room with someone and agree to commit an offense, you are punishable at that stage. Let's say the room is bugged and some law enforcement officer overhears you. You're punishable at that stage without anything more.
And you don't claim that there's anything wrong with that statute?
No. I suggest that where one agreement has two objectives, particularly the two objectives of importation and distribution, that the offense is fundamentally singular and cannot be further subdivided. In terms of the application of the Blockberger test to a determination of legislative intent, the government has argued that any ambiguity that exists can be resolved into a clear congressional intent by relying on the Blockberger test. And I suggest that it's not really a very good way of determining legislative intent. In a number of recent opinions, this Court has not looked at Blockberger in determining congressional intent. It's a way of telling, one way of determining whether two statutory offenses constitute the same offense, but it's not determinative of legislative intent, because the legislature may very well not intend to impose multiple punishment even for two statutes that are technically distinct under this test. And even, and as Justice Rehnquist noted, that where a test generally comes out only one way, it is particularly not a good tool for determining legislative intent, which may be yes, maybe no. But if a test always comes out one way, it really says nothing about what the legislature intended. And additionally, it can't be a presumptively determinative test where it results in findings of separate offenses. What it means is that if, under the test, you find that two statutory violations are the same offense, you can presume there's no congressional intent to multiple punish. And this is absent a clear congressional intent to the contrary. This is consistent with other techniques of statutory construction and resolving ambiguity in favor of the defendant, strict construction. But it only works one way. You can't simply invert it to say that where you have two statutory violations and they're not the same offense, you have a presumption of an intent to impose multiple punishment. It's like saying that where you've got a fruit that's a cherry, you presume it's not yellow. And then you invert that and you come up with a fruit that's not a cherry, you presume it is yellow. It doesn't work logically. You cannot just simply...
I don't entirely follow that. You act as if the criminal justice system that we have carried over from our English system is a totally logical one, that if there's a balance on one side, there's a balance on another. Now, the defendant has a number of the presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, things going from. Why can't you invert the presumption?
Well, I'm saying that the presumption as it stands is in accord with a number of those other protections afforded to a defendant, such as...
Has this court ever said so?
Specifically?
Yeah, that's the way we try to talk.
I cannot recall any specific language, but I suggest that it does work out to be that way. I mean, in Whalen, this court said that the test was that where two statutory violations are the same offense, you presume there's no congressional intent to multiple punish.
I must confess, I'm not sure I follow your one-way argument. It seems to me every time you've got two different offenses defined either in two different statutes or two sections of one statute, the presumption is that the prosecutor has the power to prosecute under either one, the second, or both.
The prosecutor may have the power to prosecute under each.
You don't need affirmative evidence of an intent to allow him to do it other than the fact that the Congress passed two statutes.
That's right.
And why is it different from, say, speeding and throwing a bomb out the window? He does it in one transaction. You don't have to find Congress specifically thought about these two crimes being committed at the same time and wanted a multiple punishment. You just violate two laws.
Well, I suggest that where you're talking about two offenses that are violated in one criminal episode, you may very well have to look at whether Congress intended, if the crimes are related in some sense, that they be punished consecutively. Not that you not be tried on both of them, for a jury may very well find you did one and not the other, or that you did both. But the question is whether you can be consecutively punished for both of those offenses.
Well, what difference would it make if they punished them for both, but they imposed concurrent sentences? You're nevertheless convicting them and punishing them for both offenses. So what difference would it make if they're consecutive or concurrent?
Well, consecutive sentences have a very different impact.
Oh, yes, but it's there for your purposes, I would think you would say you couldn't be tried on both of them at once. And or at least you would certainly wouldn't think that the judge could say 5 to 10 years on each count to run concurrently.
Well,
you should just pick one or the other.
Well, you have to give the trier of fact the opportunity to determine which of those two offenses, if they are not the same, did
I know, but you can seem to concede that he could impose punishments for both as long as he made them concurrent.
No, I'm not conceding that. No. I'm saying that you may be punished only once for that offense.
And I thought your further argument was, going back a little further, you can be convicted of only one. Or am I mistaken about that?
I would... The jury may
you
come
can be
back.
Tried on
judgment
both.
Should be imposed on only
both,
one.
Both, but the jury must be instructed that the conviction must be only one conviction on either, alternatively.
Right, and the court.
Isn't that your argument?
I don't believe that we had to go that far. We were simply saying that judgment should be imposed on only one and that sentence should be imposed on only one.
Even though the jury finds a violation of two separate criminal statutes?
Even though the jury finds two separate statutory violations that are, in fact, one
and brings
offense,
in a verdict of convictions,
and
two
brings
convictions.
A verdict back of guilty on both counts. The
on each
court,
of two counts.
Right. The court can only impose sentence on one.
Well, that would be an effective adoption of my brother Brennan's same transaction test, would it not?
Well, it doesn't go as far.
Well, you're just so far. I've just heard you argue statutory construction.
I believe that I did respond to double jeopardy in one question there, and I would like to reserve the rest of my time and hopefully respond to that.
Mr. Levy.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act of 1970 was designed, as this Court recognized in United States versus Moore, to strengthen existing law enforcement authority in the field of drug abuse. The Act contains two distinct conspiracy provisions in two distinct subchapters. One provision, Section 963, prescribes conspiracy to import a controlled substance, and it authorizes a sentence of imprisonment or a fine that does not exceed the penalty specified for the object offense of importation. The other provision, Section 846, prescribes conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance, and it authorizes a sentence measured in terms of the object offense of distribution. Thus, a conspiracy having multiple objectives, both to import and to distribute controlled substance implicates both subchapters, each of which authorizes a sentence based on the punishment provided for the underlying substantive offense. Notwithstanding the existence of distinct subchapters with distinct offense and penalty provisions, petitioners contend that a conspiracy involving importation and distribution of a controlled substance in violation of Section 963 and Section 846 can be punished under only one of these provisions, but not both. Surely nothing in the language or the structure of the Drug Control Act implies such a result. To the contrary, the Act on its face suggests that Sections 846 and 963 establish separate offenses that are subject to cumulative penalties. Moreover, our interpretation is also supported by the Blockberger rule. As recently as last term in Whelan, the Court stated that Blockberger is a rule of statutory construction that has been consistently relied on to determine whether Congress has, in a given situation, provided the two statutory offenses may be punished cumulatively. Similarly, in Iannelli, the Court said that Blockberger serves the function of identifying congressional intent to impose separate sanctions, for multiple offenses arising in the course of a single act or transaction. Unquestionably, the Blockberger test is satisfied here. Conspiracy to import a controlled substance in violation of Section 963 and conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance in violation of Section 846 each requires proof of a fact that the other does not.
What if it were not the case? Then under Blockberger, I suppose as a matter of statutory construction, you would assume, absent some clear indication of the contrary, that Congress didn't intend double punishment.
I think one would assume or presume that.
That's been the rule, at least on, that's the way that's the direction Blockberger looks in.
I think that's correct, but I think Blockberger...
In our other cases, but if it looks the other way if there are different punishments.
I think it looks in both directions.
Yes.
I agree. I think that's right.
So part of this case is whether these are the same or different offenses.
Well, the question on the first part of the case is whether the statutes authorize consecutive sentences, which we submit is resolved in the first instance by application of the Blockberger rule.
Well, that's on the assumption that they're separate offenses.
Well, we think the Blockberger rule in that terminology is the means to determine whether they are separate offenses or the same offense. But
Do you think your colleague agrees with that or not?
No, I believe not.
A part of this case, as I suggest again, is whether these are separate or the same offenses.
I would only take issue with the characterization of whether they're separate or same offenses. We think the question is whether the statute authorizes consecutive sentences rather than whether in any abstract sense these could be characterized as the same or different. But if that is the correct terminology, then we think Blockberger supplies the means.
Well, I'll put it the other way. Part of this case is deciding in which direction direction do we follow Blockberger in this case.
That's right. And we submit that Blockberger works in both directions in that terminology. We think that's expressed in the Court's recent decisions, its understanding of the Blockberger rule in Whelan and Iannelli. And we think that that's absolutely supported by the Court's decisions in the Harris case, the Gore case, and the Blockberger case itself, which the Court relied on the rule to hold that consecutive sentences were permissible. So we think the Court has already answered the question and held that Blockberger works in both directions, as Mr. Justice White put it.
But I suppose even if it were decided that these were the same offenses, If they were tried together and consecutive sentences imposed in the same proceeding, the government would suggest that there's no double jeopardy problem.
Certainly. I hope to get to that by the end of my argument, but we agree with petitioners in the sense that the first issue in the case for the Court to resolve is whether the statutes authorize the consecutive sentences. We submit they do, and therefore the double jeopardy question will be presented here. But we agree that that's the first issue that the Court should pass upon. To respond to Mr. Justice Brennan's question to my opposing counsel, we think this case is not like Simpson and Busick. First, after Whelan, it's not completely clear to us that the Blockberger rule applies to the type of compound and predicate offenses that were at issue in that case.
I think my question wasn't it, whether or not the same inquiries that were made in Simpson, Busick, and Whelan had to be made to resolve the question here.
Well, the question in the end was the same, whether the statutes authorized consecutive sentences in Simpson.
I think that's all I said.
In that sense, we agree with it. But we think the analysis of the particular case here is much different than the one the court employed in those cases. In particular, the court in Simpson and Busick did not employ the Blockberger test and certainly didn't find that the test was met by the statutes at issue there. And the court certainly did not suggest that if Blockberger had been met, that it would not have given some guidance, indeed a presumptive guidance, on the intent of Congress to authorize consecutive sentences. Moreover, in those cases, the court found affirmative evidence, particularly the statement of Congressman Poff and the rejection of the Dominick Amendment, affirmative evidence to support the conclusion that consecutive sentences were not intended by Congress.
Mr. Levy, can I ask you a question about, I want to be sure I understand what you're saying about the two-way use of Blockberger. You're saying that if two offenses satisfy the Blockberger test in the sense that each requires a proof of a fact that the other does not, then one should presume that Congress intended to authorize double prosecution and double punishment, or
exactly.
Permit the prosecution. And do you also say the converse, that if there are two offenses that do not each are not mutually exclusive, that then the presumption is Congress intended to authorize only one punishment?
We do, with the emphasis on the word presumption. It's a rebuttable presumption based on the specific legislative history and statute involved in the case.
What would rebut such a presumption? Something expressed in the Congress saying that even though it's a lesser included offense, we want to be a multiple punishment to be permitted?
That would be one illustration,
for
example.
It would be a very clear evidence of legislative intent.
Right. I would cite, just as an illustration, the Gun Control Act, Section 924C, that makes it clear in terms that the sentence is to be imposed in addition to the sentence for the underlying federal felony.
Is that Simpson?
We think it's not, because Simpson involved only a discrete class of felonies that contain their own enhancement provisions.
Did it involve 924?
Yes, it did. Yeah. And either the assault statute or the bank robbery statute. Yes, they were the same.
An enhancement provision would clearly be evidence of an intent to...
Exactly, even though that might not pass the Blockberger rule because one is a lesser included offense than the other.
But that would be clear on the face of the statute.
Exactly, and that's one illustration of evidence that would rebut the inference that arises from Blockberger.
But in this case, you rely basically just on the Blockberger rule itself. For the rule
that's our principal reliance here, and we think that's the first rule that should be applied in any case.
But you still... That depends on your being able to convince us or somebody that these are separate offenses in the Blockberger sense.
That they pass the Blockberger test, that's correct. And we think there's no doubt here that they do, and petitioners do not contend otherwise. So that's not an issue that's contested in this court. Petitioners do contend, however, that the Blockberger rule is inapplicable to conspiracy offenses. However, nothing in the formulation or the rationale of the rule indicates in any way the conspiracy is outside the scope of the rule. Moreover, in the American Tobacco case, this court specifically applied the Blockberger test to hold that a single conspiratorial agreement to violate sections 1 and 2 of the Sherman Act was subject to cumulative penalties. Here, analogously to American Tobacco, conspiracy to import a controlled substance and conspiracy to distribute that substance are separate statutory offenses under sections 943 and 846. And the Blockberger rule indicates that these distinct statutory conspiracies are reciprocally distinguishable from and independent of each other. Braverman versus United States, upon which petitioners heavily rely in their brief, does not compel a different result. The court in Braverman construed the general conspiracy statute not to authorize multiple convictions for a single agreement to commit several unlawful acts. The Braverman decision itself makes clear, as do the subsequent decisions in Pinkerton and American Tobacco, that Braverman is confined to a situation in which the conspiracy is alleged to violate but a single statute, and in particular the general conspiracy statute. In contrast, here as in American Tobacco, the conspiracy to accomplish multiple illegal objectives violates two distinct statutes, each of which provides for a separate penalty. Finally, our analysis under...
Under your argument, these people could have been prosecuted for three crimes under one conspiracy because I suppose they also violated the general conspiracy statute.
Now, we don't take the position here, and we think that question would raise different and more difficult questions than are presented in that case. There would be, I think, two levels of inquiry involving the general conspiracy statute. One would be whether Congress intended to preempt the general conspiracy statute by enacting specific conspiracy statutes. And if it didn't, then whether the conspiracy statutes would satisfy the Blockberger test and whether the court's decision in Braverman would require a different result.
Do these statutes require proof of an overt act?
The lower courts consistently, as far as I know, have held that they do not.
Whereas the general conspiracy statute does. And so it seemed to me that the Blockberger test would allow all three, because that's a fact that you must prove under the general conspiracy statute, which you would not have to prove under these.
That's certainly one possible analysis, and we don't disagree with it. I will say that the overt act is something of an unusual element in the normal
parlance. But it is an element of the general conspiracy.
I believe that's correct. But one could also satisfy the Blockberger test simply without reference to the overt act requirement. In other words, if Congress intended the general conspiracy statute to remain applicable where the object of the conspiracy was not subject to a specific conspiracy provision, then we think that, even without reference to the overt act requirement, would also satisfy the Blockberger test. But I emphasize that the question of the relationship between 371 and the specific conspiracy provisions is not before the court in this case.
The first inquiry, if it were before the court, would be, do these specific conspiracy statutes displace the general conspiracy statutes? Apart from any Blockberger test.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
And the court would look, among other things, to the specific history and provisions at issue and determine the question of congressional intent. But that problem is not here today. Our analysis under Blockberger and American Tobacco is reinforced by the fact that sections 846 and 963 are directed at separate evils. In particular, and I think Mr. Justice Blackmun adverted to this same idea before, importation of a controlled substance not only poses a societal harm relating to drug trafficking and the increased availability of illegal drugs, but it also involves a breach of the sovereign borders of the United States and an interference with the government's authority to regulate commerce across those borders, a wrong that occurs independently of either the contraband nature of the items brought into the country or the subsequent use or distribution that is made of them. Thus, since sections 846 and 963 serve to protect against different social dangers, a separate penalty for the violation of each provision is justified. Petitioners offer two arguments to rebut the Blockberger presumption in this case. First, that the legislative history of the Drug Control Act does not disclose a clear intention to allow cumulative penalties for a single unlawful agreement, and second, that the rule of lenity requires the construction that consecutive sentences are not permitted. It is common ground between petitioners and ourselves that the legislative history is silent on the precise question of consecutive sentences for conspiracy to import and to distribute a controlled substance. However, it is unrealistic to demand, as petitioners do, that Congress focus its attention on every conceivable issue of statutory interpretation and furnish an express and unambiguous answer to every potential question that might subsequently be litigated. As recently noted in the Whalen opinion, both this Court and the Congress have recognized that the legislative process simply does not function in the manner envisioned by petitioners. Since Congress is predominantly a lawyer's body that is presumably aware of familiar legal doctrines, it must be assumed to be cognizant of the settled Blockberger rule, and at least in the absence of a specific contrary indication, to contemplate that consecutive sentences may be imposed in cases such as the instant one, where two distinct statutory provisions meet the Blockberger test.
The opposition's reliance on Senator Dodd's statement?
Well, we have a citation in our brief to a similar statement by a representative saying that the bill that was enacted was essentially the House version rather than the Senate version. And I think that's supported by the conference report. But the honest answer, I think, is that Congress never specifically focused on the question of consecutive sentences. And therefore, it was never confronted in an immediate way with any difference that might exist between the House version and the Senate version in that regard. But Congress did enact the House version. It did enact a statute that has two distinct conspiracy provisions that meet the Blockberger rule. And we think in those circumstances, consecutive sentences are authorized.
Mr. Levy, do you see anything to the petitioner's position that this was argued as a one conspiracy case?
No, I don't believe so. That I think, poses the question in this case rather than answers it. If there had been two separate conspiracies, in the sense that I believe you're using the term, Mr. Justice Marshall, then unquestionably there could be consecutive sentences. There could be consecutive sentences for two violations of the same statute if there were two separate agreements. The problem only arises where, as a factual matter, the unlawful agreement is singular rather than plural. And it's on that basis that the Court of Appeals decided the legal question, and it's on that basis that the question is presented to the Court.
So that if Congress passed a bill that if you bought a gun for the purpose of shooting somebody and then shot somebody, you wouldn't have to shoot him. You still could be convicted of both assault and purchase of the gun. I guess Congress could do that.
I believe it could. I think those are two separate evils, and Congress has the right, particularly in an area like gun control, to enact stiff sentences, stiff provisions. Petitioners contend that the existence of two conspiracy provisions is purely adventitious and merely reflects the fortuity that two different committees considered the bill in the House. However, the history they emphasize is not inconsistent with and does not foreclose consecutive sentences pursuant to Sections 846 and 963. Rather than ineluctably confirming petitioner's construction, this history is equally consistent, we believe, with the inference that the House committees, focusing on two distinct governmental interests, concluded that a conspiracy encompassing importation and distribution comprised dual evils that should be subject to enhanced penalties. More specifically, the legislative development of the Act is fully compatible with the view that the House Ways and Means Committee, which has general jurisdiction over customs and import matters, deemed importation offenses to present not only a drug problem, but also a discrete harm involving the territorial sovereignty of the nation and the government's ability to control ingress from foreign shores.
On the other hand, the bill that came over from the administration to the Congress had merely one conspiracy provision in it, didn't it?
That is correct.
And isn't it surprising that if we're to end up with two penalties, that there isn't something positive in the legislative history?
Well, one would hope that Congress would address the question. Our lives would certainly be simpler if it had. But I don't think, particularly as this Court noted in Whalen, I don't think it's surprising that there is no discussion of this in the Act. Congress rarely specifically and expressly indicates its intent to allow consecutive sentences. Congress did enact a bill that has two separate conspiracy provisions. Those provisions do pass the Blockburger test. In those circumstances, the question is whether there's anything in the legislative history that defeats the presumption flowing from Blockburger. We think that the legislative history, in particular the events in the House that the petitioners so heavily rely on, are fully consistent with the position we take here and the resolution suggested by Blockburger. The bills that were originally introduced in the two committees were substantively identical, and each applied to both domestic and international drug offenses. The only difference between the bills concerned the type of drugs covered. The Ways and Means Bill was applicable to narcotics and marijuana, which historically had been regulated under the Internal Revenue Code and other statutes within the jurisdiction of that committee, while the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee bill was limited to depressant and stimulant drugs, which previously had been regulated under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and thus was within the authority of the Commerce Committee. Later, however, and importantly, this division of responsibilities was deliberately altered in such a fashion that the Ways and Means Committee, which, as I noted before, has general jurisdiction over customs and import matters, focused its attention on the international aspects of the bill. At the same time, the Commerce Committee addressed the domestic side of the bill. Thus, the ultimate relationship between the committees expressly and purposely emphasized the distinction between the domestic and international facets of the legislation. In these circumstances, we believe that it accords with the usual presumption of rationality and regularity of congressional actions and is not contradicted by anything in the legislative history to believe that the Ways and Means Committee was naturally aware of and concerned with not only the particular menace of drug trafficking, but also with the government's general interest in maintaining the integrity of its borders and in policing its boundaries against unauthorized entries into the United States. From the outset, the legislation in the House consisted of two bills, each containing its own conspiracy provision, and Congress, in passing the Comprehensive Drug Control Act, was unquestionably aware of the separate conspiracy sections. Accordingly, the most likely congressional understanding was that under the well-established Blockburger Doctrine, cumulative penalties would be available for the distinct conspiracy offenses defined in Sections 846 and 963. At the least, it cannot be unfailingly supposed, as petitioners suggest, that the existence of separate conspiracy provisions was a mere accident of the legislative process and that Congress never intended to authorize consecutive sentences.
Mr. Levy, do I correctly understand that if this statute in Section 1 had said importing is bad, Section 2 said distribution is bad, and Section 3 said a conspiracy to do any of the foregoing is bad, you'd disguise the other way? Now, if you had one conspiracy, one prohibition against conspiracies, then you'd follow Braverman. If you have two separate conspiracy prohibitions, you follow Blockburger.
Well, I think one would have to follow a different analysis, and I believe that Braverman likely would certainly be highly illuminating, if not controlling, in those circumstances. It is conceivable, however, in the legislative history and in some other way, Congress would indicate an intent to authorize consecutive sentences. And that situation, by analogy,
you didn't have anything beside the face of the statute.
That's right. But that situation arose, for example, in the Callinan case, where the Hobbs Act, in a single section, prescribes both conspiracy and substantive offenses. And this court held that even though there was but a single provision, both a conspiracy and a substantive offense could be cumulatively punished.
Now, my question is whether you could punish the conspiracy twice because it had two separate objects in that situation I gave you. I think you'd say no.
My assumption is that one could not.
Yeah, because there's only one prohibition against conspiracy.
That's correct, and that was essentially the analysis that was followed in Braverman. But that is not a constitutional requirement.
Unless Congress said so.
Exactly. But absent some specific indication, I think the strong inference would be that a single conspiracy provision could only give rise to one sentence. Petitioner's second argument to rebut the Blockburger rule, their rule of lenity analysis, is also unavailing. As this court has recognized in such cases as Busick and in Callinan, the notion of lenity is one guide to be used in discerning legislative intent where an ambiguity otherwise is present. In the words of Mr. Justice Frankfurter, writing for the court in Callinan, the rule is a guide to statutory construction and comes into operation at the end of the process of construing what Congress has intended, not at the beginning as an overriding consideration of being lenient to wrongdoers. In our view, the Blockburger Doctrine renders it unnecessary to resort to the rule of lenity. If, as in this case, two distinct statutory provisions satisfy the Blockburger test, it is to be presumed that offenses under those provisions are subject to cumulative penalties. Indeed, the very purpose of the Blockburger standard is to answer the question of consecutive sentences in the absence of a specific indication of congressional intent. And therefore, Blockburger serves to resolve any ambiguity that might otherwise call for application of the rule of lenity. Lenity cannot, by itself, be used to defeat the Blockburger Doctrine, and we are unaware of any decision in which this Court has found the Blockburger test to be satisfied and yet nonetheless relied on the rule of lenity to prohibit the imposition of cumulative penalties. Petitioner's counsel also relied on the fact that there are divergent authorities among the courts of appeals on the proper construction of these conspiracy provisions.
I suppose you'd say if it satisfies the Blockburger test, you could try them separately too.
I'm not sure. You mean try them in separate prosecutions? Mm-hmm. I think that raises an entirely distinct question.
Well, it may be, but I say if each requires proof of a fact that the other one doesn't, they can be tried separately, can't they?
The statute would allow them to be tried separately.
Yeah. How about the double jeopardy?
Well, it would be an additional question, one that isn't present here, whether successive prosecutions.
What question would it be?
Excuse me?
What question would it be?
Whether successive prosecutions rather
than... different offenses?
Yes, that would be the question, whether the offenses are the same or different offenses. And even if they were different offenses, as the court held, for example, in Harris versus Oklahoma and In re Nielsen, the Double Jeopardy Clause might still bar successive prosecutions. That would rest, I suppose, on some notion of finality for the defendant's benefit, an interest that simply is not presented in the context of multiple punishments following a single trial and a single sentencing proceeding.
Although I recognize you're stressing the use of Blockberger as a statutory construction aid, you don't deny that it has some relevance to the constitutional inquiry, do you?
Well, the court has on occasion indicated that Blockberger has some
relevance. Of us thought for many years that was the constitutional standard. You don't deny that, do you?
I don't deny that for many years.
And so it might still have some relevance to the constitutional question.
It might still have some relevance, yeah. Although, as the court well knows from our brief in Whalen, we believe that the double jeopardy issue in that context is no different from the question of whether the legislature has authorized multiple punishments.
But Blockberger, at any rate, did not originate as a constitutional doctrine.
It did not. The Blockberger case itself was a question of statutory construction, as were the succeeding cases in Gore and in Harris, among others. Petitioner's counsel seeks to find an ambiguity in the statute because courts of appeals have diverged on the proper construction of the conspiracy provisions. I would only point out, as Mr. Justice Rehnquist suggested, that virtually every federal criminal case heard by this court involves a conflict in the circuits, including those cases in which the court finds that the meaning of the statute is plain on its face, or declines to apply the rule of lenity. And I would cite the court as illustrations to the Lewis case in 445 U.S., the Culbert decision in 435 U.S., and the Scarborough decision in 431 U.S. Moreover, since the rule of lenity is merely a device to ascertain congressional intent, it is not applicable, we believe, whereas in the drug area, Congress intends to deal severely with serious criminal violations like those of petitioners. In Gore, this court declined to extend the rule of lenity to federal drug laws because Congress had manifested an attitude not of lenity, but of severity toward such offenses. As the court recognized in Moore, Congress did not follow a different course in enacting the Drug Control Act of 1970. If, as we urge, the court concludes that sections 846 and 963 authorize consecutive sentences, the imposition of such sentences on petitioners does not contravene the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Fifth Amendment. First, it is our belief that the court in its recent decision in Whalen did adopt the view that the Double Jeopardy Clause does not bar consecutive sentences that are authorized by the legislature and imposed at a single sentencing proceeding following a single trial. Since Congress did authorize cumulative punishments here, the Double Jeopardy Clause is no more offended than if Congress had enacted an equivalent statute, as Mr. Justice Blackmun mentioned, which expressly provided a maximum term of imprisonment of 10 years for conspiracy both to import and to distribute a controlled substance, and 5 years for conspiracy to engage in only one of the prescribed objectives. But in any event, even if it is assumed that there are some circumstances in which multiple punishments authorized by Congress could be unconstitutional under the Double Jeopardy Clause, petitioner sentences in this case would nonetheless be valid. To the extent that the clause is applicable here at all, the Blockberger test would, as Mr. Justice Stevens suggested, furnish the standard for determining whether separately defined crimes constitute the same offense for purposes of double jeopardy. And I think that's the phrasing that Mr. Justice White referred to before. Here, these statutes clearly satisfy the Blockberger test, as we discussed previously. In terms of double jeopardy, this case is no different from one in which, for example, the defendants conspire to import goods without paying the customs duty in order to obtain an unfair competitive advantage and attain a monopoly. Surely, such an unlawful agreement could be punished if Congress saw fit as a violation of both the smuggling and the antitrust laws. Contrary to petitioner's basic premise, nothing in the Double Jeopardy Clause forbids Congress to conclude that an agreement to commit two offenses is more pernicious and should be more severely punished than an agreement to commit one offense. Thank you.
Very well. You have just 1 moment remaining, 1 minute remaining, counsel.
In that 1 minute, I would just simply like to say that we do contest the applicability of Blockberger, A, to the conspiracy situation in general, and B, to this particular conspiracy situation where each one does not require proof of a fact that the other does not, since you can infer the objective of distribution from the same facts that prove the importation. And it suggests that American Tobacco, which is the only case that the government has cited as applying this, is distinguishable on the grounds that, A, it was dicta, the portion discussing the consecutive sentences for Section 1 and 2 violations, and, two, that Sections 1 and 2 of that Act are very different from the conspiracy provisions here. Section 1 of the Sherman Antitrust Act is, in a sense, almost a substantive provision. It prohibits a conspiracy in restraint of trade and makes engaging in that an offense, while Section 2 is conspiracy to monopolize. So there might be different reasons for saying that under those circumstances, consecutive sentences might be permissible. And in addition, it's the Antitrust Act, which this Court has recognized, and commentators as well, has not been construed in the same manner that normal criminal statutes have.
You think that antitrust statutes are to be construed much more strictly than drug statutes?
No, I'm saying that the antitrust statute has been given a much broader construction, a looser construction in terms of effectuating its goal as a pro-competitive free enterprise statute, and that this Court has, I believe, in United States Gypsum, recognized that it has not construed the Sherman Antitrust Act and other antitrust acts in the same manner that it construes penal statutes such as the drug statute. It's given a much more broader construction.
I'm not sure I follow you. Do you mean that society's view is that it is not as serious to commit antitrust violations as it is to import drugs or vice versa?
No, I'm suggesting...
Which is the more offensive to society?
Well, it's not a question...
Or is there no difference?
...of which is more offensive to society. It's a question of this Court's having, throughout its history, construed the Sherman Antitrust Act differently. And in addition, at the time of American Tobacco, these were misdemeanor offenses. The civil sanctions were much more compelling than the criminal misdemeanor penalties. So I'm just saying that relying on that decision to, as a general proposition, that Blockberger has been applied to other criminal conspiracy contexts is inappropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in California.